content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the December 2023 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from the New York Times titled, "In Florida's Hot Political Climate, Some Faculty Have Had Enough." Liberal-leaning professors are leaving coveted jobs with tenure, and there are signs that recruiting scholars has become harder, by Stephanie Saul, published December 3, 2023. Governor Ron DeSantis had just taken office in 2019 when the University of Florida lured Neil H. Buchanan, a prominent economist and tax law scholar from George Washington University. Now, just 4 years after he started at the university, Dr. Buchanan has given up his tenure job and headed north to teach in Toronto. In a recent column on a legal commentary website, he accused Florida of open hostility to professors and to higher education more generally. He is not the only liberal-leaning professor to leave one of Florida's highly regarded public universities. Many are giving up coveted tenured positions and blaming their departures on Governor DeSantis and his effort to reshape the higher education system to fit his conservative principles. The Times interviewed a dozen academics, in fields ranging from law to psychology to agronomy, who have left Florida public universities or given their notice, many headed to blue states. While emphasizing that hundreds of top academics remain in Florida, a state known for its solid and affordable public university system, they raised concerns that the governor's policies have become increasingly untenable for scholars and students. The University of Florida said that its turnover rate is not unusual and remains well below the 10.57% national average. Hiring, it said, has also outpaced departures. Florida State University and the University of South Florida released similar figures. Governor DeSantis's office did not respond to requests for comment, but Sarah D. Lynn, chair-elect of the University of Florida's Faculty Senate, said that little has changed except that her campus has become the focus of national politics. Most people who leave, she said, do so for reasons that have nothing to do with politics. Florida isn't really a unique scenario when it comes to the politicization of higher education, said Dr. Lynn, who teaches in the Department of Family, Youth, and Community Sciences. It's a beautiful state to live in, and we have amazing students, so we're staying. Data from several schools, however, show departure rates have ticked upward. At the University of Florida, overall turnover went from 7% in 2021 to 9.3% in 2023, according to figures released by the university. A report by the Faculty Senate at the University of Florida found some departments hard hit. The School of Arts, which includes art, music, and dance, struggles to hire or retain good faculty and graduate students in the current political climate, said the report issued in June. In liberal arts, the report said, faculty of color have left. Danaya C. Wright, a law professor who currently chairs the Faculty Senate, said she sees job candidates avoiding the state. We have seen more people pull their applications or just say, no, I'm not interested. It's Florida, she said. At Florida State University, the Vice President for Faculty Development, Janet Kistner, commented during a Faculty Senate meeting in September that the political climate in Florida had contributed to an upswing in faculty turnover, with 37 professors leaving for reasons other than retirement in the past year, compared to an average of 23 during the past 5 years. Paul Ortiz, a history professor at the University of Florida and a former president of the school's faculty union, is leaving after more than 15 years to join Cornell next summer. If the academic job market was more robust, then a lot more people would be leaving, Dr. Ortiz said. Walter Boot, a tenured psychology professor who had secured millions of dollars in grants for Florida State, is headed to Weill Cornell Medicine in New York, where he will continue developing technology for the elderly. Dr. Boot said he joined Florida State in 2008 and immediately felt at home on the Tallahassee campus. This was the place I could see myself spending the rest of my career. Great department, great university. Things began to change, he said, when the DeSantis administration started to push its education policies. Dr. Boot, who is gay, cited a 2022 law that limits what educators can say about gender and sexuality in elementary schools. It was not technically aimed at universities, but it fueled a frightening environment, he said. The run-up and aftermath of its passage involved hostile rhetoric painting queer and trans individuals as pedophiles and groomers, rhetoric that came not just from citizens, but from state officials, Dr. Boot recently wrote in the Tallahassee Democrat. he pointed out that soon after the bill's passage, a man threatened to kill gay people on Florida State's campus. "It's been very difficult from a day-to-day perspective, not feeling comfortable or even safe where I live," Dr. Boots said in an interview. Other gay professors cited recent state sanctions aimed at transgender employees and students who do not comply with a law passed in May restricting access to bathrooms, as well as state restrictions on transgender medical procedures. Hope Wilson, who was a professor of education at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville, had served as an advisor to the school's Pride Club and worked with the LGBTQ Center. Dr. Wilson said that she particularly objected to what she regarded as intrusive requests from the state for information, to which her school responded on everything from how many students had received transgender care to expenditures for DEI initiatives. "It just felt very dystopian all the way around," she said. Her professional discomfort was matched by personal worries because her child is transgender. "Florida isn't a state where I can raise my family or do my job," Dr. Wilson said. She landed at the Northern Illinois University. To Christopher Rufo, a conservative writer and activist whom the governor appointed as a trustee of New College of Florida this year as part of a campus shakeup, "Faculty departures are a plus. To me, this is a net gain for Florida," he wrote in a statement, railing against diversity programs and transgender medical care. "Professors who want to practice DEI-style racial discrimination, facilitate the sexual amputation of minors, and replace scholarship with partisan activism are free to do so elsewhere. Good riddance." The University of Florida's law school has been particularly hard hit this year, with a 30% faculty turnover rate. Some of those professors said political interference contributed to their departures, while other faculty said Florida's reputation had deterred professors elsewhere from joining. Miriam Jamshidi said that after a 2021 law permitted students to record professors in the classroom, liberal-leaning professors feared they would see videos of their lectures on Fox News. "As a Muslim woman who works on issues of racism and American power, I didn't feel like UF was a place I could safely be myself and do my work," said Ms. Jamshidi, who now teaches at the University of Colorado Boulder. "Questions about gender and race are fundamental to an array of legal arguments, from constitutional law to criminal justice and workplace discrimination. But in May, Governor DeSantis signed a bill that regulated what can be said in the classrooms and also barred university spending on diversity programs. By that time, Kenneth B. Nunn had already decided to leave, one of several black law professors who had recently departed. In 2021, Mr. Nunn had been barred from signing a brief challenging state restrictions on voting by felons. Mr. Nunn said that signing such briefs is something that is considered a matter of course for faculty to do anywhere else. The school later reversed itself on the question of whether he could sign, but Mr. Nunn took the episode as an indication of the university's direction. He opted to retire from the law school and is currently a visiting professor at Howard University. For Dr. Buchanan, the economist and law professor, a final straw was the institution of a review process for tenured faculty, which he viewed as the end of academic freedom. "It's not just that the laws are so vague and obviously designed to chill speech that DeSantis doesn't like. It's that they simultaneously took away the benefit of tenured faculty to stand up for what's right," he said. "It's tenure in name only at this point." Since Dr. Buchanan writes on tax policy from a progressive perspective, he said that he felt he could become a target at any time. "The Republicans who are running Florida," he said, "are squandering one of the state's most important assets by driving out professors who otherwise wouldn't have wanted to leave." The next article comes from U.S. News, and it's titled, "Biden Administration Cancels $5 Billion in Federal Student Aid for 80,000 Borrowers." The move is the latest in a series to provide relief to as many borrowers as possible in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision to block the president's sweeping debt cancellation plan. The Biden administration announced on Wednesday that it approved an additional $4.8 billion in federal student loan debt cancellation for roughly 80,000 borrowers. The move is the latest in a series of efforts underway at the Education Department to provide student loan debt relief to as many borrowers as possible in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision this summer to block President Joe Biden's sweeping debt cancellation plan. To date, the department has approved $132 billion in federal student loan debt cancellation for 3.6 million borrowers. "It's historic," Education Secretary Miguel Cardona told reporters on Wednesday, speaking about the totality of relief provided. "No other administration even comes close. We are being intentional about ensuring that higher education is affordable." These latest discharges are the result of this administration's relentless efforts to fix a broken student loan system, he said. When I first joined the department, I was appalled by the dysfunction in our existing student loan program. It was virtually impossible for eligible borrowers to access the student debt relief they rightfully earned. The latest round of relief stems from fixes to the income-driven repayment plan and the public service loan forgiveness program, bringing the total relief derived from those two buckets to $44 billion and $53.5 billion, respectively. The department has also canceled $11.7 billion for borrowers with a total and permanent disability, as well as $22.5 billion for borrowers who were cheated by their schools or saw their institutions suddenly close. This level of debt relief is unparalleled, and we have no intention of slowing down, Cardona said. Indeed, in October, the department began the formal regulatory process to provide debt cancellation to potentially 5 additional groups of borrowers, which Cardona announced they would pursue after the Supreme Court blocked what was set to be one of the Biden administration's biggest policy wins of his first term. I vowed to improve the student loan system so that a higher education provides Americans with opportunity and prosperity, not unmanageable burdens of student loan debt, Biden said in a statement. I won't back down from using every tool at our disposal. While it hasn't necessarily garnered significant attention, the administration has been making top-to-bottom changes to the American higher education system, including the finalized rule for how for-profit colleges must prove their graduates are gainfully employed and earning enough to pay back their debt in order to be eligible to receive federal student aid, and a blueprint for colleges and universities seeking to continue using race in their admissions process in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling that barred the use of affirmative action. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, Teachers Face Backlash and Discipline for Political Stances on Israel-Hamas War. Last month, a Queens high school teacher hid in a locked office on campus for hours to avoid hundreds of the school's students who had taken to hallways in what news reports called both premeditated and raucous protest aimed at the teacher, whose profile photo on Facebook pictured her at a pro-Israel rally, raising a poster that read, I stand with Israel. In California this week, a teach-in by a group of teachers in the Oakland District on the lives of Palestinians in Gaza and its history drew sharp opposition from the district's superintendent, who sent an email to parents and staff members saying the lesson is, quote, neither sanctioned nor approved by the district, according to news reports. Also this week, in Maryland, the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, announced it has filed an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission complaint against the Montgomery County District, alleging the school system placed a Muslim teacher of Egyptian national origin on administrative leave because of her email signature tagline, which expressed support for Palestinians. Before the teacher was placed on leave, someone tore a Palestinian flag from her car, according to CARE. As these examples illustrate, the Israel-Hamas war has ignited strong passions and has put many students and educators in a painful position of trying to process their own feelings and views of the crisis in an already deeply polarized political environment. Teachers, especially those who teach social studies and history, likely will find themselves navigating conversations related to these fraught subjects and how they relate to previous historical events. They also may have their own strong opinions on the conflict, as well as other current national and global events. And as recent events show, they could be targeted for attacks because of those public stances. But there's a fine line between teachers presenting information to students about politically charged current events and these same teachers expressing how they feel about them. A variety of constraints shape what teachers can and can't share about their personal perspectives about the Israel-Hamas war or other polarizing topics, in classrooms or during their personal time. For one thing, teachers' free speech rights aren't absolute. Generally, teachers can share their personal opinions about their political beliefs outside of school, but while they're in classrooms, they represent the school district, and courts generally have given states and districts have wide latitude to prescribe what content is covered. Teachers can be punished for deviating from that content. Second, new laws place restrictions on how educators can teach certain subjects deemed controversial, including racism and sexism, and in some cases, current events. The nation's largest teachers union notes that, even when collective bargaining agreements allow teachers to present controversial issues to their students, they typically ask them to follow guidelines that include this one. The teacher must be fair, balanced, and not advocate a particular viewpoint. And finally, educators' opinions diverge. Consider, for instance, this unscientific LinkedIn poll in which Education Week last week posed the following question to K-12 school and district leaders. Do you have guidelines around staff expressing their personal opinions about the Israel-Hamas war? Among the 201 respondents, 78% said no, just 22% said yes. It's impossible to know why most survey respondents reported not giving teachers any guidelines around the sensitive issue. Independently, educators, from those responsible for guiding teachers on best practices to classroom teachers, weighed in on the topic in phone interviews. Despite varying opinions, they each espoused information sharing, mutual trust, and student-centered guidance. There's a section titled, Classroom Conversations. Few educators said academic discussions of the war should be off-limits in the classroom, especially in social studies classes. We don't tell people what they can and cannot say in the classroom. We look to them to use their professional judgment, said Cheryl Logan, the executive director of the New McGraw Center for Educational Leadership at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education and a K-12 administrator for more than three decades. Wesley Hedgepeth, the president of the National Council for the Social Studies and a history teacher at a private school in Richmond, Virginia, explained what that kind of professional judgment means to him. When it comes to civic-type issues, as a classroom teacher, I will present multiple sides within a classroom and let the students decide based on the sources I provide them, he said. As far as the Israel-Hamas conflict, I give students sources to digest from multiple perspectives. I give them the chance to drive the conversation, Hedgepeth said. He admits that this isn't always easy. Everyone has bias. Even those who earnestly try to be unbiased cannot completely escape unconscious bias without significant training. One of the safest ways to mitigate this in the classroom is to ensure multiple perspectives are presented, Hedgepeth said. For him, that involves drawing from sources that fall around the center of media bias charts, such as those from AllSides.com and Ad Fontes Media. But figuring out which sources are trustworthy can be challenging. Hedgepeth also said he and all social studies teachers try to follow guiding principles when it comes to developing curricular plans, implementing daily lessons, and establishing rapport with students and other educational stakeholders. They include such tenets as integrity, justice, authenticity, civic engagement, responsibility, and democratic values. Like Hedgepeth, Chris Steer, Louisiana's 2020 Teacher of the Year and a high school history teacher at Benjamin Franklin High School in New Orleans, also mentioned the significance of teacher-student dialogue in his classroom. I do feel this generation can have conversations with each other, he said. Deer described making an effort to provide relevant context to his students so that their conversations can be both informed and respectful. Even though current events in the Middle East are not part of his world history course at this time of year, Deer set aside time after the October 7th massacre of Israeli citizens and soldiers and the subsequent war for discussion with students. He provided historical background and shared news articles covering the recent incidents. After students had a few days to digest the information, he initiated class discussions and gave students the opportunity to present questions and comments. With everything so polarizing and intense, I tackled it in all of my classes, Deer said. Students asked a range of questions. What is Hamas? What was the Six-Day War? Overall, students' perceptions were incredible, said Deer. So too, he added, was their cordiality. Having respectful two-way conversations about sensitive and polarizing topics with students is a challenging task that requires laying groundwork up front and doesn't come naturally to all teachers. That's where school leadership needs to play an active role, believes S. Kambar Koshaba, a high school principal in Lorton, Virginia. In an opinion piece in Education Week, Kashaba asserts, we can't leave teachers alone and unequipped to direct these conversations. Kashaba acknowledged the difficulty of initiating this type of dialogue and recommended that principals get support from colleagues, supervisors, and others. Let's teach each other about ways to support and not offend each other. We might not be able to have a direct impact on a war happening so far away from us, but we can have an impact on immediate school communities, he wrote. Whether such conversations in the classroom should include teachers sharing personal viewpoints remains up for debate, though. I always tell students on day one, as objective as I'm going to try to be, there may be times when I will have a bias or view things in a certain light, Deer said. I encourage students to research and fact-check everything I'm saying. Hetchpeth said he avoids inserting his own beliefs into the classroom conversation. I tell my students that it doesn't matter what I think. It's what they think that matters, he said. But he supplies students with background knowledge before asking for their opinion. The University of Pennsylvania's Logan advises against teachers sharing their personal beliefs about public and polarizing issues. I do not recommend that teachers share where they stand, she said. We all stand for humanity. That's really what our statement as teachers should be. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from K-12 Dive, and it's titled, Report, Some States Cut Education Spending Amid Pandemic Uncertainty. Dive Brief. During the 2020-2021 school year, states scaled back pre-K-12 education funding to levels not seen since the 2008 Great Recession, according to a report released Monday by the Education Law Center, a nonprofit that promotes fair and equitable school funding. In looking at variations in state spending, ELC found that some states, such as Colorado and Hawaii, significantly reduced the total amount of state and local revenue allocated to districts. Other states like Illinois and New Jersey didn't implement planned funding increases. As states start planning for fiscal year 2025, and as funds run out from the federal COVID-19 emergency payments, ELC urges policymakers to prioritize education funding in an effort to sustain pandemic-era investments in schools. Dive Insight. Danielle Ferry, ELC Research Director and co-author of the report, said one of the big takeaways from this year's annual report is that state funding still shows disparities in equitable and adequate funding, both between states and among school districts within states. For example, the research showed that among some states, such as Utah, Delaware, and Minnesota, per-pupil funding in high-poverty districts is 30% higher than in low-poverty districts. But in some other states, like Oregon and Nevada, high-poverty districts received 30% less per pupil than low-poverty districts. A lot of states fund their education systems regressively, so that the students that are in the highest poverty districts actually receive less funding than students in low-poverty districts, which is the exact opposite of what all the research and literature tells us the students need, Ferry said. Per-pupil funding varied greatly among states in 2021, from a high of $27,265 in New York to a low of $10,536 in Idaho. The national average was $16,131. ELC researchers also looked at the efforts states are making toward prioritizing school funding by reviewing pre-K-12 revenue as a percentage of the state's economic activity, or gross domestic product. They found that while New York and West Virginia both rank high in school funding effort, New York, which was relatively wealthy with a high per capita gross domestic product, was able to have a much higher per pupil funding level than West Virginia at $16,091. If a state has a very low effort, it suggests that it can increase its revenues by increasing the taxes or however to generate more revenue off of the state's economic capacity, Ferry said. For high-effort states that still aren't generating enough revenue for schools, that suggests there's room for greater federal investments or some other support, she said. The report acknowledges that while the 2020-2021 school year saw a 3% enrollment decline from fall 2019 to fall 2020, those enrollment losses likely did not affect funding allocations because state finance formulas typically use a prior year's enrollment count to set aid levels and are not adjusted mid-year. The next article comes from the Washington Post, and it's titled, Harvard Faculty Alumni Fight for President as Push for Free Speech Grows. Hundreds of Harvard professors and alumni are fighting to save the job of President Claudine Gay, calling on the university to stand firm against politicians and donors clamoring for Gay's removal over testimony she gave before Congress on anti-Semitism last week. It is part of a growing push by some faculty and school leaders at Harvard and beyond to preserve what they call the fundamentals of free speech and open campus dialogue, which they say are under attack across America from actors on both the political right and left. Gay has faced intense pressure to resign since a December 5th House hearing, at which, when asked, she did not say that advocating for the genocide of Jews would violate the university's student code of conduct. She later apologized for her remarks, which drew condemnation from prominent alumni, politicians, and even the White House. The Harvard Corporation, which has the power to remove Gay from her job, met on Monday. Harvard representatives declined to comment when asked about the subject of the meeting. Meanwhile, letters for and against Gay circulated. In one, more than 650 Harvard faculty members urged the governing board to defend the independence of the university and to resist political pressures that are at odds with Harvard's commitment to academic freedom, including calls for the removal of President Claudine Gay. Black faculty at Harvard also wrote a letter, signed by well-known professors including Annette Gordon Reed, that called Gay a superb selection as president. There are those who are taking upon themselves to take her presidency and turn it into a kind of plaything in the culture wars, said Cornell William Brooks, a professor of the practice of public leadership and social justice. And more than 700 black alumni and allies signed yet another letter stating Gay had compassion for all people on the university's campus. Gay became president in July and is the first black person to hold the job. She has worked at the university since 2006 and was previously dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. Meanwhile, a petition imploring Gay to resign and lambasting her, quote, lack of moral clarity, had drawn 1,000-plus signatures as of Monday. One of Gay's most vocal critics is prominent alumnus and billionaire hedge fund manager Bill Ackman, who wrote his own letter to Harvard's governing boards lamenting President Gay's failures, which he said have cost the university billions in donations, a figure the Washington Post could not verify. The debate over Gay's future comes days after Liz McGill, the president of the University of Pennsylvania, resigned because of widespread anger, including donor threats to yank funding, following testimony she gave at the congressional hearing alongside Gay. Derek Penslar, a professor of Jewish history and director of Harvard's Center for Jewish Studies, signed a letter whose theme he described as, quote, an affirmation of the autonomy of the university from political pressure. The bigger issue we're addressing is who and how will we decide who leads the university, Penslar said. Will decisions be made in response to external pressures, or will they be made by the people who actually are invested in the university, which is the faculty and administration? A Republican-led House committee questioned Gay, McGill, and Massachusetts Institute of Technology President Sally Kornbluth for hours last week about how they will handle anti-Semitic behavior. All three schools are facing allegations that they have allowed anti-Semitism to run rampant on their campuses since the October eruption of war between Israel and Gaza. Congress and the Education Department are both investigating how Harvard, among other schools, handled incidents of bias. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.